It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
They might talk about humor, music, film, books, football, and box sets, exercise, and maybe even food. Trivia and sport, politics and health, sometimes well-being too. On the Life with Brian. On the Life with Brian.
Hello, how have you been? Life with Brian is back for the new season with me, Mark, co-host Matthew, and the main man, Brian McClare. Welcome back, chaps. Have you had a good summer?
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much.
Yeah, been, well, felt like a long time. Hasn't been that long, but it's good to be back and good to see you and talk to you both.
And I'm pleased to say we've got a special guest with us today. It's Spanish football expert, journalist, podcaster, and big dandy, which is Aberdeen fan for the uninitiated. I'm pleased to say we've got Graham Hunter with us. Pleasure to have you with us, Graham. How was your summer break?
Well, thank you, first of all. I didn't recognise the adjective or know what I've done to... It was special, maybe special needs. You can get into that later on, but I don't think the adjective was merited. My summer was really quite good. I ended the season pretty knackered, which is not normally the case for me. Maybe it's just a weird life we've had, the pandemic squeezing games every 3 days. I mean, we don't even have to do any of the running or rehab and all that kind of stuff. But it was straight into the European Championship, which I loved. I was contracted to be with Spain the whole way. They treat us well. We get into training camp. I thought they played increasingly good football, and I just enjoyed being around them. They gave us really good access, and by the time the semi-final was over, I was quite impressed with Italy, but I was also pretty determined that the team that I was working with, I've worked with so often, was the best side in the Euro and should have gone through and should have won it. And then after that, it was onto a hired boat, just a, you know, a company that hires boats for me, my wife and my two kids up in Loch Ness in the Caledonian Canal. So it was, to be honest with you, it was a really special summer. It was fantastic.
So were you travelling with the team, Graham? Is that the way it was in this Euros? It wasn't done remotely.
It was a halfway position, Matthew, because previously, we did get the, and I find that, I mean, I don't know what Chuck will say, but yeah, we've travelled at World Cups and Euros with Spain, and I've been with them since 2006. And when you're flying with them, there's a real tension, particularly if you're a producer journalist with a camera crew with tons of equipment. And it's 3 a.m. in a foreign city, and you've gone through the airport control, and they're tired, they're the workers, they're the heroes, they're the ones that are keeping you at the tournament. And you have to make sure that all of you have got all your equipment. You have to pray that the airport you're in, whether it's in South Africa or Brazil, it doesn't matter where, aren't going to pick on you to stop. Because obviously, when you come onto the plane, nobody that's played is going to be interested if whether it's your fault or not that the last one on, you've added an hour to the journey home to wherever it might be. But this time, no, we didn't travel with them. The COVID protection was much, but we got into the training, and we got face-to-face interviews with the players and the coach. And just that ability, this is good to what we're able to do now on Zoom. And all of us have got used to it really quickly. But to be sitting face-to-face with somebody and be able to see what, you know, what they're like when they come in before the camera starts rolling, to make a few jokes, to try and explain to them who you are, to try and make them feel comfortable at speaking in a 10, 15 minute window, and they're, you know, 20 and you're 58. You know, there's a bit of a process in that. So we were, the lucky thing is, one, we beat the pandemic and all the rules that we've had to suffer so far. But this time, no, we've been airplanes and hotels with them in the past, which harks back to, I guess, that when Brian started to play, teams and journalists did travel together, and it was much healthier. It may not always work, but it was much healthier overall.
Yeah, they did travel, yeah, and all of that was fine, because it was part of it was down to the at those times, both at Celtic and Man United, was the pound note shake-up, because you guys had to pay. And I'm sure it was the same if you were. This isn't maybe the same any kind of situations. And now it's, you know, there's different reasons for doing different things. We've been kind of, and well, in situations you just mentioned there, where you've not been able to, because you have to create a bubble round and make sure that the players and everybody else are available to participate in those games. So bit by bit, hopefully that'll dissipate.
But I think, I mean, genuinely, I mean, you can knock this, it's your podcast and you know better, but you can knock this out the window if you want, but any time where decent journalists, not just anybody, and teams or managers or physios or whoever, and directors and presidents, are either travelling together or have got to be in the same space, hotel or bus or whatever it might be, more, it might lead to explosions every now and again, but it does lead to seeing that, you know, to some degree, we're all human. Sometimes I came in at the tail end of it, but I had fun. We travelled with Celtic to Batumi. I don't know if you're obviously not at the club then, but I travelled with Celtic to Batumi in Georgia, and it was at a time when Georgia had just been suffering a typhoid epidemic. They just tried to blow up whatever his name, Shevardnadze's car on the way out. The Russian plane felt a bit ropey. We got stopped, we got hijacked, because they obviously recognised that Fergus McCann was good for it. We got hijacked for 20 grand on the way back. They stayed the militia on the runway after Celtic, I think, had won at Dinamo Batumi. And there was trace of fire in the distance because there was still civil war going on. And we were held up by Shavuan gunmen on the tarmac, and Fergus was forced to pay $20,000 before they let the plane take off. We were just covering this, and we'd had our vodka in Georgia prior to the match. We'd had our night out, and Gary Keown was playing the spoons outside the hotel in the darkness, because that's what Gary liked to do. And Tommy Burns, the nicest man on the planet, Gaz, leaned out the window, so, you know, Gaz, you don't shut that racket up, I'll shove them spoons right up your ass. Now, that might not be the best example of mutual understanding, but I think it's a good one. I'm saying those days, there were better chances for people to get to know each other.
Well, we can, yeah, and what you just told us there is a fantastic story. Or two fantastic stories. Well, a fantastic with two different parts, isn't it? You know? I mean, your memories of a wonderful place, and Fergus McCann being someone who probably doesn't get the credit for transforming Celtic Park, and Tommy Burns, who's one of the most wonderful people I've ever met, you know.
Yeah. So
it's two parts that, you know, Fergus would be fuming having to, you know, I'm sure he'd be trying to negotiate. Maybe did negotiate.
But at the end of a carbine.
Yeah, attempted to negotiate that, and then for Tommy Burns to be turning around and saying exactly what he would say in the dressing room, scenario, which is out with what maybe his public persona as a Celtic manager would be. So
would it be improper, either of you, now to tell you my best Tommy story?
I don't know.
You tell whatever story you think. So, I've told me about
this. I've started in journalism full time in Scotland. I've been part time for a few years, and I'm in the paper. And it's Champions League tie, and Rangers get beat 4-0 at home by Juventus. My boss goes, "We used to see foreign teams come over and maybe being better than Scottish teams, maybe beating them, but not pushing them around and beating them, pushing them around physically. So you've got to tune in and find out what the story is." So I flew over there. The press officer was unbelievable. He let me in. Did a big report, interviewed Viali, spoke to the physical trainer. This is mid 90s. It'd be 95-ish. Anyway, I come back, I write my article. The phone goes a few days later, and the desk secretary in the paper goes, well, Graham, it's a Celtic manager for you. And naturally, I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake, what have I done now? What have I said now? Why is there going to be a row? I'd never met Tommy Bryan. So he came on, I can't do it. Hello? Hello, is that Graham? Hello? Hello? And I'm like, hello, Tommy. And he's like, I read your article. Read your article. He said, I want to go over there. I want to see what you saw. Can you fix it up? We go right back now. I'm like, Tommy, are you kidding? I've got, yeah, I want to go to your event. I said, okay, wow. All right, I'll phone them back. So, I'd been back in the country about 10 days. Phoned your event. I said, listen, Tommy Burns wanted to come back and do exactly what the... And Daniele Boaglia, who was the guy. Right, okay. So we fly out there. And I'm absolutely on my best behaviour. I've never met Tommy before. I knew his reputation as a decent guy, but he's the Celtic manager, I'm a junior reporter, blah, blah, blah. We get there, and before all the treats of Marcello Lippi sitting at a table over lunch with the interpreter, showing us the formation that he thinks Real Madrid will play in the European Cup quarterfinal later that spring, and how Juventus are going to beat them, and sitting watching training with Lippi slagging off Paulo Sousa because he's got three jackets and three hats on in the Turin winter, and he goes, look at that guy, he's laziest guy in training, useless in training, look at him with his three hats. He said, match day, always perfect. And I went, okay, that's a great quote. And all that's going on, but the first thing that happens to me is, we're in our rooms, we've checked in, the phone rings in the phone, and I pick up the phone, and I can't do it. I pick up the phone in this Turin hotel, thinking, God, I'm here to see Lippi and Juventus, I'm here with the Celtic, and there's a Donald Duck voice. It's a Donald Duck voice, it's a brilliant Donald Duck voice. I'm like, the fuck's going on here? Is this a crackly line? Is the hotel full of mentlers? It's fucking Tommy's had nothing better to do once he's unpacked and fucking phoned me and put on a Donald Duck voice, which he goes on for about, a good minute and a half. And I'm still not quite broken through. It's the Celtic manager, but we sort ourselves out and we get on and we sit. But, that was the thing that united us, because we sat in open mouth wonder at what we were seeing and how they were treating us. And Tommy had, I don't know if you remember this game or you played in it, but Tommy had played in the Celtic-Juventus tie in something like 1980-81, vaguely. And Lippi was like, God, yeah, and now I can picture you in it, blah, blah, blah. So Tommy, man, great man. Donald Duck.
Of course, Tommy was responsible for you having the nickname that you still go by, Brian, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Well, he didn't choose it. I mean, he made it stick. he was determined. He was a wonderful person. I mean, just some of the things he used to come out with, sense of humor. It's like the two of the funniest, if not the two funniest people I've ever met in football are both gingers. That's Tommy Burns and Strack. Both of them are just been so quick-witted, and then there were a partnership, or sort of saying kind of partnership again at Celtic, where Gordon was the manager and Tommy was helping him out. So some of the things that just wonderful.
I've got nothing on Tommy memories compared to you, but for anybody who's listening to your podcast who doesn't know Tommy, you can look at the football videos, but there's one that I've seen. You can go on YouTube and see Tommy at a dinner where he sings a cappella, Mat the Knife. I'm actually getting a bit emotional, and he just stands up at a dinner and sings Mat the Knife, I think to raise money for charity. And also when I was maybe 10 years in Barcelona, when Tommy died, I was sitting in my flat alone, tearful, I have to say. And for those who, I'm not Glaswegian, but I lived in Glasgow for a long time. For those who don't know the Glaswegian divide or politics or attitudes, to see who carried the coffin and to see Starkey speaking at the cathedral, and it just couldn't, Billy Sharp couldn't fucking get a sentence out without weeping. But Walter there, and Walter speaking, Walter Smith, the Rangers manager, because Tommy unified people, unified clubs, beliefs. He cut across everything. And I just wish I'd known him better. One of the things about moving away to London was that I wasn't around quite so much in his Kilmarnock days and whatever. But just an unbelievable man. Unbelievable. McClare's on mark!
Just going to change things, well, not change it, but I'm going to hola, le amuleta. ¿Qué tal?
Estoy muy bien, muchas gracias. ¿Por qué me llamas amuleta?
So when you are wandering about the streets, is it, are you from Aberdeen? Are you actually from the city of Aberdeen?
Yeah, yeah,
just
one of
those little hamlets outside.
Ah, well, okay, we could argue about that.
But it doesn't really matter about that. When you were wandering around, and right, I can imagine you were doing the same thing that I was doing, that people will talk about, and a lot of people that you've come across about, they'll talk about the science that's involved in football. We'll talk about visualization. In our time, because you're the same age as me, it was called daydreaming. When you were like wandering around as a 14, 15 year old, right, potentially with maybe a carry out, thinking which shoot I can park myself under to have a can or two. At which point did you think that, I think that my future is going to be the lucky mascot, the four-leaf clover for the Spanish national team?
You or all of you are very good, because I did fucking wonder about telling Vicente Del Bosque and Xavi and I don't know who all else that I was the lucky mascot and they won the World Cup because of me. That's true, I did say that. When I was visualising, I was a weirdo. I used to wear...
You're doing it now, visualising. It's fucking daydreaming.
I can see myself in sort of shorts, a red nylon tracksuit top, and that wee tartan bonnet that Ronnie Corbett used to wear. You know, the one with the peak or Nicky Lauda, Jackie Stewart used to wear. So it's tartan bonnet, tiny wee peak, and the wee pom-pom on the top.
So you stole Ronnie Corbett and Jackie Stewart's hats. How did you manage that?
More or less. Well, I end up having dinner with Ronnie Corbett and flying in Jackie's private plane. So there's something, it's not just visualisation. It's like the big man upstairs has got a brilliant sense of humour, or there is synchronicity. I used to wander around like that, never thinking I'd be the lucky mascot for Spain, but thinking I have to get out of this place.
Aberdeen or Scotland?
Certainly Aberdeen. Aberdeen was full of people who were wealthy and who thought the world began and ended there and you didn't need anything else. And I was like, bollocks to this. I didn't dislike it, I didn't hate it. But like when Fergie arrived, I'm 15. And Fergie arrives, and it isn't instant, but what you learn by listening to him and watching, I'm a rabid fan. I love the Dandies. There was a good joke about the Dandies at the beginning, but I love the Dandies. I can't even begin to express it properly, what they mean to me. But they changed me. I'm watching, Alec moved into Quarry Road, the top of Quarry Road, which overlooks Colts Academy's playing fields. And it was which got semi-attached next to my best friend, attached to my Graham Ramsey's house. So the runs he's got to know the Fergusons, I got invited a little bit to go around to Graham's or maybe kick the ball over the back and pop in and say, can we have a ball back, Mr. Ferguson or Mrs. Ferguson, whatever. Two things apply to what you said. One day I met Mrs. Ferguson around the neighbourhood in Colts. And she said to me, hello, Mrs. Ferguson. She went, I've seen you. I've seen the bigger boys picking on you. I've seen how they try to have a go at you. She said, don't let them do that. So we never met Glaswegians before. I've been down to Hampden, seen us yes, no in games, but we never lived around Glaswegians. She was like, don't, and she just did this because she knew I was a friend of Graham Runcie, she knew who I was, I played a bit of sport, and that really impacted on me. Kathy was like, I've seen you, I know, and okay, so that stuck really hard. I thought this. And you watch and listen to Alec. I mean, not at Manchester United, not what he is now, but for my team, telling the players, go and win in Glasgow, talking to the press in a way that, and you're like, yeah, the world is bigger than this. You could take on anything you want. It just went straight into me. And the way to tail this off now is to say that instead of like a wee carry out under the chute, our best trick was Phil the Pill Smith, his music teacher, Phil the Pill Smith, worked in Agnews. And it was on halfway between where we lived and into town. And in Agnews, in the back store, he found that there was a brick dislodged, and it must have been underneath the air brick that lets air flow in from the street into just, you know, area. Any building has air bricks. Whereas the brick under that was loose, and it was a big brick. So what you could do was, he took a half bottle of brandy and stick it halfway in there, just tilt the brick a little bit so that you could just get the head of the bottle from the outside of the pavement, pull it, move the brick as you pulled it, then push the brick back in place again. But you never left the shop with a bottle of brandy stuffed down your tunic or anything like that. So that's how our early bevying start, thanks to Philip Hill Smith and half bottles of brandies as we rehearsed as the Trees. We were in a band called the Trees. And that's what we did. And we mixed in, sometimes if the brandy was running low, we'd mix in Benlin or whatever, or do all the tricks that you thought were clever back in the day. But that's how I became the Amuletter, more or less. There's nothing else to it.
All right, okay then. So the question about from that time and from the near distant past, right? If you were a player, all right, which team would you choose to play in and why, right? Fuck. Fergie's Aberdeen, yeah, or Guardiola's Bath?
Without any question, there's two quick ways to answer that.
Not only, you know, did I, you know, adore the way that Guardiola's Bath played it, inspired me, it changed me, it gave me shivers, it inspired my words, it just lifted me up. I thought it was glorious, and I admired them. But nothing. Oh, fucking hell, Brian. It's fucking 7:30 in the evening, and I've had one small bottle of cider, and I've got something in my eye. I can't speak about it without getting emotional. Nothing, apart from my wife, in my life, and my daughters, nothing has ever done the same thing to me as us. First of all, taking, it doesn't have to be beating, but like regarding the Old Firm as like, well, yeah, we'll fuck it, we'll take you on, we'll have you, we'll chase you. If we lose, we'll come back next time. And then you go through, you know, you see European teams coming, and I noticed when I wasn't allowed to go to a game in 72, Borussia Mönchengladbach came, and it was they were brilliant, and Netzer was already in my mind because he had the flowing blonde hair and whatever, and we'd seen him, not in the World Cup, but in the European Championship. They came, Capello came with Juventus, all these big names came, and I wasn't allowed to go. So we started to go, and I saw RWD Molenbeek, one of the great world brand names, and then Eintracht Frankfurt and whatever, and gradually you saw Hamburg with Beckenbauer playing for them, and we're winning, and then we chuck it away, and then by a minute, can we beat them? You're like, fuck my old sea boots. And that was almost better for me than the final. Just seeing us 2-1 down, but beating by a minute, it taught me everything about life. So the answer is without question. And also, when I was a moderately decent hockey player, we won leagues playing in a former pupil centre for the school in Aberdeenshire Leagues. And I went to university and I played hockey in a team that played like, the idea was like Guardiola's thing, where it's like, you play in systems, it's rules. You play 1-2-3, dish, dash, da, ba, ba, ba. And I was like, nah, man, improvise. So I was the prick. If I was in that Barca squad, I was the prick who wouldn't have fitted in. Going, oh, Pep, oh, no, hold on, just let me be me. And I'd have been hooked and playing in Zaragoza in 10 minutes. But you struck a raw nerve there. If anybody would invent time travel and God would be friendly, yeah, boy, I'd be, yeah. Dirty Dingus would have to sit on the bench and I'd be playing number 9 for the Dandies. Sorry, Dingus.
By a million miles.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
When I was doing a bit of the internet can never be trusted, but when I was doing looking up a couple of things that tickled my imagination about yourself was that there was, from what I can gather, I knew you can expand or ignore or do whatever you want to do with this, but there seemed to be two epiphany moments in your journalistic career, and there looks as though to me that there's two people, maybe you've already done this, that are owed or you've already paid the tariff of a case of the finest Riocher. And one of them is Pierre Van Hooydonk for staying up all night playing cards, right? That's the first one. Stop, you'll notice. The other one is maybe a bit more contentious, is that Colin Gibson, you also probably owe a case of...
Oh, fuck. I didn't imagine it'd be an easy ride on here. And before the thing, we all agreed that I was able to strip at that fat fucking fraudulent cunt.
What, Van Hooydonk?
No. Listen, I don't know if any of the three of you have got an equivalent How Did That Happen story that does actually...
Oh, so first of all, do you agree that Van Hooydonk, you found out that... If he stayed up all night playing cards, got you a gig.
If he doesn't take the phone call from the Breda guys going, listen, Big Pierre, we're having cards and Berry tonight, you're not going away to Celtic unless you... I'll be there, don't worry. And they drink and play poker all night, they miss the flight. And I've gone in to remonstrate. You know, I've been on a Dublin, the mad Hogmanay, and I come back and I've thrown a CV, which you don't do in newspapers, into a new opening newspaper where there's barely a desk and there's wires hanging. And, just 10 days before I've given my CV in, and by the time I come back, I've had such a big bevy in Dublin. I'm like, irate they haven't spoken to me or asked me. So I storm in, and they're like, you can sling your hook at the fuck, whoever you are. And I'm getting hooked out. I'm deservedly being hooked out. And the fax goes ping. And somebody across the room is going, wait, Moose. It was Moose kicking me out. Wait, Moose. There's a player being unveiled at Celtic. Brian Scott's up at Pittodrie waiting for the manager to be sacked. We haven't got a reporter. And I could see the chief is going, oh, bollocks, look what we're going to have to do. Shut up, bollocks. So they say to me, listen, can you go to Parkhead and report this without fucking up? I was like, I can. Jump the taxi, get out to Parkhead. There's a set of, I don't know, gargoyles on the right-hand side growling, and it's the Scottish press, and they're fucking on kind of, and I'm like, oh, I'm not speaking to them. And there's a set of 6'8", you know, just a handsome, blowing fucking cunts in clogs on the left-hand side, and I'm like, got to speak to Dutchies. And they're like, hi, can you show us a kilt shot? When Big Pierre gets here, we're going to put him in a kilt and blah, blah, blah. And I say, yeah, listen, it's only a couple of years ago since I got married, I'll tell you where to go. Where is Pierre? It should be. And they're like, oh, they're all like, oh, he's told Celtic that, what's this stupid airport at Schiphol? He's told Celtic that Schiphol's fogged in and he can't, but really what's happened is he was on the bevy with the boys playing cards last night. He's missed his flight. So we go through the press conference. Nobody asked a question from Scotland. They're like, well, why is this 2.5 hours late? They're like, we are all, you know, inside they're all thinking, we're all scum, we decided we're the scum, we don't need to be told why it's 2. So they don't ask a question. So I go back. And they're like, right, have you got anything? Why have you been so long? I'm like, well, I've got all the quotes. And by the way, this is what's happened. And I've checked it with the agent and all that kind of stuff. They're like, suddenly that, does anybody else know this? And I'm like, no. They're like, back page. And literally, it gets the back page. They're like, to me, come, let's sit down. And they're like, there's a sting in the tail. I don't know if you know this, but the sting in the tail was they're like, we'd like to give you a contract. I'm like, yes. They're like, would you, a rugby reporter. You're like, what the fuck? So a week later I'm at Stirling County winning the title. Oh, so anyway, so you're right, Big Pierre, I owe him everything.
And you've bowled me a fucking stinker, man. I mean, what? I liked being in a newspaper. Newspapers are addictive. I cared about standards. I managed to cope with the fact that Paul Dacre, the editor at the Mail, wasn't the man that he became. I didn't think it was such a mad, stupid, vile paper as it became later. And I really quite enjoyed... No, I really loved my work. Living in London, my job was to report Manchester United, Arsenal, Chelsea, England, Liverpool. It was fantastic. I came in, I was deputy sports editor. The editor got ill immediately. I was on my own for 6 months, having not had any experience, straight from chief reporter to being... And Paul Dacre, the editor, calls me in one day and says, look, I've been through all the candidates and I've picked one that I think you'll get on with, and two, I've said to him that you have to stay as his deputy, and that's the end of it. Before very long, call me a nosy bastard, but before very long, him and his sidekick that he brought in, they'd left, they'd gone away home at night because they didn't like a day longer, about 5 hours. They'd left their laptop open and had a list of all the people they wanted to sack. And there was good reporters and they were just going to fuck them out. And I was irate. And I'll tell you, listen to that, why? He's fucking me, you got my dander up, Chucky, for fuck's sake. He's a horrible man. So we get told by our city desk, it's a fact that this is going to happen. It's a fact that Tottenham are going to announce Glenn Hoddle as their coach. It's a fact because Enoch, the company that owns them, are bound by city rules. We've had a briefing. And Gibson's like, no, Glenn, my mate, he's a Southampton man. We're going to do a big feature on him as Southampton boss and there for the future and all that. And he was told 3 or 4 times by the city editor, you're wrong. You're no. He goes down there. The idiot they sent, there's rumours that you're going to... No. So it's a back page and spread about Glenn Hoddle, Southampton. 2 days later, he's the fucking Spurs manager. Then there's a time where your club, sorry if this is in English, announced a partnership with New York Knicks or whatever the fuck. New York Yankees. And he's like, right, this is brilliant. This is a fucking 6-pager. And you're like, hold a second. You know, we've got to report it, but it's not that... It's not fucking all that room. We've got big... No. My mate, whatever his name is that is up there, I can't remember what his name was. So he's a guy who shafted people, abandoned journalistic principles, was self-centred, lazy, and he went to the editor and said, either you sack him or you sack me. So I lost my job, and, you know, it landed with me moving to Spain. It landed with us having time to extend our family. It's been good. But I hate cheats and liars and cowards. And anybody who's listening to this must do too, and that's what he was. And thanks for the question. I see now what agents say about the footballers. He'll want to see the questions in advance.
No, but there were not this in the questions in advance because I just made them up this morning. So these two are not seen.
Yeah, don't worry, you're not the only one.
between you all, you've taken my middle stump beautifully done.
So you must have been quite pleased about how he got on at the FA then.
He excelled beyond all belief because he was the one who, when the news of the world came and said, we've got this story about X or Y, he said, I'll give you Sven instead, don't publish it. What about Sven? Sven's shagging such and such, and I could give you. And he sells his manager out, the manager of the England team, whether he's doing well or not, he's like, I'll give you something, I'll give you human sacrifice. If in the Mayan terms, he'd have been the first to say, float, which, no, sink, which two? You know, I mean, that's the kind of person he was. So, yeah, he was to do with the scandal that erupted around Sven. And eventually people told the story and went, he's the head of comms for the FA has sold the manager out. So he got the pump there too. And I was absolutely, as you say,
broken up for it.
Yes, and you would be... Change of tack to hopefully bring a smile to your face. I'll give you the Rolling Stones, I'll give you the Beatles, I'll give you Primal Scream, I'll give you Stone Roses, I'll give you the Clash. I'm not, unless you were taking the piss, maybe you weren't, maybe it's something to do with your childhood. Can you explain Dean Martin?
I'll throw that back at you. Can anybody explain Dean Martin?
Well, I can explain to you that for the first 5 years of his life, he didn't speak any English. He had to speak the Italian that his father spoke.
Correct.
So he got picked upon when he went to school because he couldn't speak English. And one of the things that they, later on in his life, he was talked about, that people said to him when he went, when he was at parties, he said he was rude. And he said, well, actually, I didn't feel even then that my English was good enough to have a conversation with people, and I just to take myself off into the corner.
And he became a boxer as well because of all of that thing about needing to prove himself and needing himself to stop getting beaten up.
Is that why? Is it because of his life story or because of
he tells it because that, that because he'd always felt got at and not good enough ever, that he became pugilistic, and then they taught him, and he was a decent boxer, a decent fighter, you know. You can see that his face...
So does that go back? So can you just rewind a bit then? After Kathy told you, don't fucking let these people push you around, what did you do?
That's a really good question. I took a decision that I would be me, no matter what, that I wouldn't... I mean, I did get punched a lot at school. I don't know if people will be listening, but Simon Cruikshank caught me with a square right hook on the jaw in the playground. But I took it, and I remember when there was a fight, instead of just jump on, we didn't have a rough school, but there were bikers came round with bike chains and the teachers came out to batter them in the playground. And there were fights all the time. There was two people that really picked on me, Porky Lindsay Reid. We fought to a standstill for 40 minutes over a dinner break. He was bigger than me and everybody was scared of him. And later, there was other people who made a better job of knocking him down.
Was this after Cathy gave you advice?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah. You stood up for yourself after that then?
I decided to be, to not curtail the things that come naturally to me, which right throughout my life people have disliked me for, because I am noisy, I don't speak the same way as other people, I certainly don't dress the same way as other people, and there's undoubtedly times when legitimately people have just disliked me, and I'm okay with that. And if you peel the surface, maybe you won't, but at first, and people don't like you to be different, often don't. Maybe it's become more fashionable in the modern times, I don't know. But what I decided was, I am what I am, I'm going to stick to that. And what's more, much more important than what you do if there's a fight or if somebody's having a pop at your trying to book, much more important is you don't worry about it. You don't waste an inch of time thinking, what will other people think? You do care about the feelings, you do care about the quality of your behaviour. But you don't go around thinking, if I do this or that or the next thing, maybe somebody's going to pick on me or dislike it or think worse of me. You get to stage going, right, well, bollocks, I'll just be me. And it served me reasonably well over the years. And it started there. It definitely started there. But Dean, you know, I'm surprised. First of all, I'm a romantic, and it stands for an era, which if you peel away the surface like you tried to there and you look at the Rat Pack, and what they did and how they behaved, and Sinatra particularly, you're like, well, there was a lot of obnoxious behaviour. But again, if you look at how they were at that era in the States, there weren't many mixed, you know, black and white gangs nicking about together in song or in art or in theatre or cinema. They were, the Rat Pack, you know, it wasn't a laudable lifestyle. But it's one I could imagine myself living in the time. I think his voice is brilliant. I think his voice is exceptional. And it moves me and it touches me. And also, in style icon terms, if you look at him, he's nuts. I don't see why James Dean is the image. Dean Martin is the image. So he touches sort of parts of me which are like maybe romantic, maybe a bit daft. But I defy people not to think that era, those suits, those clothes, the laddish mucking around, the drinking, whatever, isn't an attractive thing to imagine. It's never going to be ours. But I like it, and I liked him. Now, his wife always said that he was distant and hard to live with and that, so I wouldn't elevate him as a great person, but fuck me, what a voice, and what a canon of songs as well, in my opinion. And I don't think he'd come out of Desert Island with me anyway if I asked him.
Life with Brian. All right. What's your favourite Stones album?
The one that they exile, it's got to be, because partly because of the music that's on it, but partly because if you think about how often a recording exercise is properly documented. So I'll listen to things over and over again. But Exile was for an astonishing reason. Where they lived, down on the Mediterranean coast of France, down the south, how they behaved, what they got away with, how they then went, I think, to New Orleans to add and re-record. So instead of just listening to it, I love, maybe it's why I write a little bit, I love things that lift the lid. So if you put together what you can listen to and what we know of the absolutely insane way it was recorded and the insane thing, so you've got them leaving the country for tax reasons. You've then got them immediately being investigated by the French police and Interpol for reportedly extraordinary drug purchases and drugs uses. You've got interchanging of girlfriends, depending on who was in the mansion at the time. And you've got Charlie Watts pissed off that he can't get a nice cup of tea and disgusted that they've got to live in France. And Charlie's like, he sits there with his little soul. Oh, I didn't like it because, you know, and so I went home. And you're like, there are few things that have brought great music to us like that, that are so well documented.
I had a nice little story the other day about Charlie Watts and Mick Jagger, and Mick Jagger was being the diva that he's always been, and there was some kind of debate about something, and Mick turned around to Charlie and said, you just got to understand that you're my fucking drummer. At which point it was then Mick stormed off or whatever, and Charlie was sitting there for a little while and said, I'm not having that. So he went up to the hotel room that Mick was in, knocked on the door. Mick opened the door, was upon Charlie, smashes him straight in the face with a perfect right hook and says, what you've got to remember is you're my fucking singer.
I think I watched him recently. I think he only punched him once, I think, and that's it. And you've, for my taste, you've gone for pugilism again. Maybe Dean couldn't have thrown a punch like Charlie, but I don't know enough about music or about jazz. But two of my favourite drummers, it's partly due to the personality, will be Charlie and Topper Hidden. And the Clash always say, and I can't explain it, and I don't know the veracity of it, the Clash always say that he was a jazz drummer. And therefore, his part in the rhythm section was sufficiently different that it made the overall sound different. And whether that's true of some of this, like, I don't know enough about music, but I think over the years, one of the reasons that Charlie must have been the perfect, apart from his calm, otherwise calm demeanour, is that he drums differently. And you know the reverence and that Keith has got for Charlie. And maybe every you know, guitar, rhythm guitar and drummer feel the same way about each other, I don't know. But I often think about the fact that two of the drummers that I like most have got this shared background in jazz music. So.
Well, do you own a turntable?
I do own a turntable. I do. It's sadly not in use at the moment. We're in a very small flat, as you can see, because I'm broadcasting from our back bathroom.
So I do. I did wonder. I was going to ask anyone that can't see.
Well, given the quality of the questioning so far, Matthew, I thought I'd better fucking get my retaliation in first here. I do. Of course, I own a turntable, and the one I wish it was Lynn, because when I got my first job in Glasgow College of Technology in 1987.
Offensive taste, you?
Well, we worked with, was his name Ivor Tiefenbrown? I think his name was Ivor Tiefenbrown who owned it. If I made that up, I apologise to everybody and whoever owns Lynn. But Lynn at the time, because you remember at that time CDs and mini discs and cassettes, but less so, were all eroding at that stage, turntables and vinyl. And he kept saying, no, for us and for this technology, there will always be a market. But it's taken, I mean, how many years would you say until it was easily accessible to get vinyl again in, say, in shops? And now it's, you know, it's ultra trendy.
25 years, if not more than that.
It's a long burn, wasn't it?
No, of course. I mean, I've always had vinyl. And a few years ago, I was quite pleased that when I went to, when I used to go to some charity shops, you used to be able to pick up a lot of really good stuff. And then I was dismayed that a few years later, I think it was probably Oxfam cottoned on that vinyl was worth, if you went down to a record fair or whatever else, as you were paying a reasonable amount of money for vinyl, particularly original vinyl. And now you find in shops, and Oxfam were the first one to start it, that I'm looking at and going, 75, 50, you know, 40 quid for second time vinyl that they're saying that is in good condition, but there's, unless there's a turntable in the shop, which there wasn't really, then you just take the chance of assuming what is good condition. I mean, good condition or reasonable condition is depending on what you like to listen to. So you might, your favourite album might have been, had a scratch in it, it might have jumped at a particular point in it, but
correct,
it was the album correct you bought at that particular moment, yeah, and it was your album.
Yeah.
And that's how it has been. So I like the idea that there's a lot of stuff comes out then, and a lot of stuff is like a record store day. And this year in the UK, they had two kind of record store days, and lots of people were recording or re-recording or reissuing different things on vinyl and different colour vinyl. So and I've always felt that, I mean, I was into that right away. I mean, I was into CDs came out, and I think I bought a CD player in about 1985. I think one of the first ones I bought was King of America, Elvis Costello, alongside Paul Simon's Graceland, and the convenience of it. And I used to make up mixtapes because you had a tape player in the car. So I used to do that sort of thing. So it was a lot easier to do, to skip parts of it. But when you listen to it back and forward, and learning of different things and listening to artists over the period of time, is that they recorded at a particular time or in a particular format there was, and it's supposed to sound a particular way. So it's supposed to sound a particular way when they were recorded for vinyl, or even before that, you're going back to 78 RPM. And then you'd see the it compresses it, that's the whole point of getting it on such a small thing, and then mini disc, whatever. So I like the thing that it's gone back to say that actually LPs and vinyl are better, and that a turntable should be one of the most important parts of your hi-fi system. And they're not, and you can get turntables that are not that expensive for what you want to do. Lynn did all that stuff. They did everything, but very, very expensive. But they also sponsored a wonderful group in the Blue Nile.
Blue Nile, yeah.
And their stuff was you could see why they would want to have Blue Nile, because or whether it was because of vinyl, it was because of Lynn, I don't really know. But Blue Nile stuff lends itself wonderfully well to being played on an expensive system that's not expensive, it's a system that's quality, and you're paying for what you get.
It reminds me of food, you know, because people love Burger King and McDonald's and all that kind of stuff, and fast food and freezer food and that. And it functions and it works, and a lot of people will say, "Ah, that'll do me." And then you get the fashions for like, well, if you cut your own ingredients, and whenever I've got cousins who are Italian, but also I've lived in Spain a long time, and you go to the markets and it's beautiful colour, and you can see fruit and fish. And it reminds me of my youth when you went into a grocer's and you could smell everything, and coffee was in sacks. But there came a time when things needed to, or became quicker, and some of the quality, like if the comparison that I think in my head, that the quality of the needle and the vinyl and all that stuff got excised. And we were tricked a little bit because, like you, I love the mobility of cassettes and mini discs and compact discs you couldn't run around with, but you could do different things, or if you travelled, or they're much more portable. And if you had a busy life, that was super. But for when people talk about slow cooking now and quality of ingredients and all that kind of stuff, and I think it wasn't just the technology of it evolving that
elbowed records out for a little while. It was people's attitudes in society, and everything was meant to be quicker. And do you sit in the same place or stay in the same room as often as you used to for a turntable and a record? And I think for a while that went away. One of the happiest things that ever happened to me, we were renovating a house in London, and without telling my wife got with a nice turntable downstairs in the sitting room, but that meant you had to sit there. And she somehow got the guys who were working on the house to wire it such that you could, just with rudimentary buttons, flip the speakers so that you had speakers in the bedroom and the dining room and all that kind of stuff. And so you could play your records and be wherever you wanted to, and the beauty of that. And also the shopping, you know, because now we're online and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I worked in the other record shop in Union Street in Aberdeen. I shopped in 1UP. I used to love, I'm sure it's called Tower Records in Glasgow. And when Tower closed, I was distraught, and, you know, 1UP's gone now. But the beauty of picking up a 10-inch Clash import, which had the Armageddon time on it and all that kind of stuff. Just the tactile thing about possessing it and reading it and opening it. 1974 Scottish Walk-Up Squad with the gatefold blue, with ring-a-ding-a-ding, we support the boys in blue. It was a gatefold with the Scottish crest, and it was blue. Oh man, I thought that was just fucking heaven. But that's only me.
So what you would do then when you were in that flat in Glasgow, was it a flat in Glasgow?
Well, we had a flat in Glasgow in Apsley Street in Partick,
where the speakers
in London. That was in London. That was in London. Yeah.
In London, then he could change the speakers into the bedroom.
Yeah.
So you'd put the Ravel's Bolero on the turntable.
No. If you want a piece of living room,
and then flick it on.
If you want to get into the mood upstairs, it wouldn't
flick it onto the bedroom speakers and take it by the hand.
No.
Come and listen to this.
If you really want to draw me down, let's think about James Last and A Walk in the Black Forest. Maybe that's, you know, maybe that's it.
So what you're saying is that you can see yourself all the way through the Bolero. Keep the tempo going.
Sting and Tweedy didn't invent tantrum.
I don't know where we go from that, Mark. Did you have anything you wanted to talk about music or?
No, I think we'll move swiftly on from the rhythm of Ravel's Bolero. Matthew, you were going to ask about a question about Lionel Messi.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to bring it. We spoke of music, and I was going to bring it up to the sort of modern day. And I was going to say, Graham, anyone that follows your Twitter account, tweeting about the Lionel Messi situation recently, the departure from Barcelona, it seemed like you were quite emotional about the whole thing. And I just wondered what your take on one of the biggest transfer stories in years was.
Well, if you mean emotional, if you mean disgusted by emotional, I'm not sad. I've had, you know, I've been Charlie Bucket in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, everything, I don't know what I've done to deserve the luck I've had, because, you know, you come to Spain at a time when Barcelona, I didn't come because I'm a Barcelona fan, I came to Spain because Steve Archibald was here as an Aberdeen player, and I thought, if Steve can do it, I can do it. Brilliant. And Barcelona were in crisis then, back in 2002, and they were ridiculous. They were in the middle of a six-year spell without a trophy. So I didn't know that Iniesta and Xavi and Valdes and Piqué and Busquets were going to erupt and great things, and Ronaldinho was going to sign and great things were going to happen. Didn't know that. Didn't know that the Galactico era, as they call it, was going to add, you know, Ronaldo and Beckham and blah, 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 blah. And it became really interesting. And then I didn't know that Spain were going to play a brand of football that you know, I think changed the international world and did something nobody had ever done before, which is Continental Trophy, World Cup Continental Trophy. Nobody's ever done it before. And in the heart of all that, I mean, if you think about the joy that gives somebody who loves football, breathes football, and gets the chance to use words about it. And in the middle of all that, you get a diamond in the crown, which is Lionel Messi. And partly because of perseverance, partly because of good timing, partly because of luck, and maybe partly because of some skills. I've interviewed him 26, 27 times, I don't know. I've seen him sneak away with David Villa into an F1 race car at Montmel on a boot launch day when the boot launch was at Mount Miller, the Formula One track, and they were testing cars, and the F1 guy had a car with a pilot and passenger seat that, you know, zip around at 240 kilometers per hour, incredible, and they sneaked away without Adidas knowing, without Barcelona knowing, just ahead of the 2010 World Cup, and went a couple of laps around Mount Miller at 240. I've seen, you know, it was Villa came out second, but Messi came out with his legs wobbly and his face green. You know, the number of times I've interviewed him, the number of times I've watched him, the number of times he's left me speechless. I think he does. Maybe all three of you will laugh at me because football is a pitiless game. It doesn't have much memory. It doesn't have a lot of loyalty. But something keeps us all still believing to a certain extent. And I had hoped that however he left, it was at his own discretion. And it, certainly however he left, he didn't come thinking. Also, he's a family man. Footballers are human beings. And it doesn't matter that that's well established in this podcast. It's a concept which has been ripped up and fucking pissed on by people in my industry, by sponsors, by fuckwits everywhere. They think of players more now as commodities than possibly ever since, you know, cricketers were gentlemen and players. And they're not. So it's not unfair, just because he's earning hundreds of millions of euros, that Lionel Messi, that we should allow Lionel Messi to think about his wife and kids, who he promised would be staying in Barcelona, who he told, it's great, we've agreed a deal with the club, we're coming to sign. They were told they're coming to sign. And then the president, who's been negotiating with him for weeks, and knows that the salary cap is completely out with their grasp, says, I've changed my mind, you're not staying. So some of the questions are like, why, and the finances, and should he be at PSG, and all that pish. He's a genius of a footballer, he's a genius of a sportsman, who stands up there with Peter Weir and Tiger Woods and Muhammad Ali and Michael Jordan. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we've all got to genuflect and wish we could touch the hem of his garment and all that kind of stuff. But he does deserve respect and decent treatment. And he was fucked around, Matthew, to be quite honest with you. And okay, he's going to earn tons of money. He's probably going to win lots of trophies. And probably it's going to be good for him and the kids to live in a different country where in the winter the sky is grey, where it gets quite cold, where it rains a lot, and they speak in a language that none of them understand. Probably that's going to be good for them. But to see him treated like that, it's not that I've lost him from my little playground. I've had more than you could possibly have wished for, seeing and being inspired by him. He's changed my career. He's changed my life. So I'm happy for him now that he's at Paris Saint-Germain. I'm happy for him that he's getting paid shitloads of money. And I think that, you know, although football is not just a conglomeration of middle art lemons and curlies and Harlem Globetrotters, and they're going to win everything, because I think they've got the right mix of positions, of hunger, a good coach. I think it can be exceptional. And I'd much rather see a year of Mbappe and Neymar and Messi up front, you know, with Verratti and Flippin, Ander Herrera and Marquinhos and Ramos and Ashraf and Donnarumma and whoever all else. I would watch that. I would be really interested to see how do they fit then? Who can beat them? Why can people beat them? How happy is Messi? Does Neymar behave himself? Does he get slim again because he's got a bit of a pot belly after the summer? All these things fascinate me. And if he goes out and they rip Europe apart, there's a question about how Paris have afforded it. Yes, there is. But you kind of get away from what we see on the pitch at the end. And if you're a supporter of one of the clubs that gets tossed aside in France, or if you're a supporter of one of the clubs who are just up now, not at the level of Manchester City and Chelsea and Paris Saint-Germain, your nose might be out of joint. But for me, for the moment, I can't change it. I didn't make it happen. I want to sit and consume it and enjoy it a lot. So I was just pissed off about how he, and there, you know, there are people who break their leg at 21 and get packed out of football and their family life is ruined and all that, and you should be much more sorry for them. But I thought I was sorry for him because he was treated ridiculously badly.
Sorry, we all know the problems the club were in, the mess the club were in. I mean, in hindsight, what would have been the best way to do it? To tell him 6 months ago that this was going to happen, and maybe let Messi announce himself and depart the stage of his own accord?
If the president's only been in since March, and since then he's been working out, you know, one, what's the money state, and two, where are we vis-a-vis La Liga financial play rules, fair play rules, and how can we get close to that? So he tried, there's no doubt he tried to ship players out. It's a bad market. They couldn't get the salary level down. The pandemic isn't the fault of either the previous president, who is a complete dolt, or the current president, who's a bit quick on his feet. So my answer to you, Matthew, would be like, either they bit the bullet and told him early and said, we're not going to get there, or they try and tell him earlier. But what stinks a little bit is that the current president, John Laporta, who undoubtedly initially wanted Messi to stay and did sell players and did try to get the salaries in general down, he was telling them that they were signing a deal long after he knew they weren't. So the ideal thing would have been not together. Arsenal sticking out the window to the extent they are, which is 1.4 billion in debt. That would have been ideal. Secondly, treating like a man and saying, listen, we'd love to renew. We know you want to stay this season. Yes, Laporte has run a campaign saying, vote for me and I'll keep Messi. Another politician's promise broken. But I don't, he's so robust because he's happy. He's got a lovely wife. He's got three kids. He's got talent that can keep him playing for another 3 or 4 years. He's won just about everything except for the World Cup, albeit he won it at the youth level. Leo Messi's life is not one that a lot of fucking thunder and rain has fallen into. So I'm not saying get your violins out. But I think if we can't even treat people like that with respect, what future do we have for the players who are not at his level? And whether it's your Walsalls, Wolverhamptons, or, you know, Lille or Bordeaux, I don't care. Don't get yourself in that situation and don't prolong the lie. Tell him straight weeks ago, and don't have it on the day that the press and Messi's father and Messi are all told he's coming to sign, and then bosh, in the meeting say, sorry, that was piss, you're out. That's not good enough.
Sorry, Brian, I interrupted you there. Did you have something to say on that?
No, all I was going to say was that Barcelona's philosophy or the tagline or the statement, mission statement on the seats is more than just a club, because of the connection between all the people, and I can be empathetic with that from, and you can as well, because we live in Scotland, and you can kind of squeeze it down into having one major club in Catalonia and one major club in Scotland. But what that kind of means about the identity, Aberdeen, yeah, you can have a look at even that kind of, you know, that kind of thing, and say what happens in your time supporting Aberdeen. That it seems to me that the time and time again, not the players, not the coaches, and not certainly not the supporters, but the presidents and the board seem to piss all over that. And this is another situation where, for me, they've pissed all over it. You know,
I think you can drag me off Michelin Club and Barcelona anytime you want, immediately if you want. But Messian Club was invented in the late 60s by somebody who, you know, at that stage, Franco's dictatorship still had 6 or 7 years to run. There was a slight relaxation, a slight glasnost, if you pinch Gorbachev's Russian term, whereby, to some extent, in the late 60s and early 70s, Catalans weren't being killed for opposing Franco and dragged off to the top of Montjuïc and tortured. It was still restricted, the Catalan language was still banned. And Mexican Club was something that was dignified then because it was, as you say, a melting pot for beliefs and passions. And basically the cops started to leave them alone if they were singing Catalan in the stadium and the Catalan flags went out, whereas you couldn't do that in your balcony or in the street, etc. And it went into abeyance for quite a long time, Mexican Club. It was there, but nobody cared about it. And it was only when the people underneath Laporta came into power in 2000, 2003, and I think they thought it was a marketing tool. Mexican Club, because they there was no, you all remember that, pardon me, when Laporta came to power in 2003, there had never been sponsorship, I think, in only two senior clubs. That's right, but Athletic and Barca had none. They asked the socios to agree that there could be, and they tried to sell it to every possible company in the world. And then when they couldn't, because they were asking too much, they went, let's have a little tactic. Let's pay a million to UNICEF and look how clever we are and blah, blah, blah. And that'll unblock things, which was really smart. And then they dusted off Mexican Club because, look, we're investing in you. But if you ravel it right back, they were investing in UNICEF because they couldn't get Bwin or Bet365 on there. And I'm not saying it was a cheat, but it was an artifact. So as soon as they stopped that, it kind of went into abeyance. And Mexican Club wouldn't have treated Eric Abidal in the way that they did, where they told him when he was recovering from liver cancer. Ah.
That was the other one I was going to refer to. They promised him the new contract, and then when he recovered, they
fucked him off. At the door, thanks, goodbye. So, you know, the trouble is in this conversation, Brian, for Mark and Matthew and I, you could match every anecdote we have or point we have, probably with a million of your own experience. So let's not be naive. Football has never been a particularly loving, hugging, cuddly, friendly place. But there are examples of extraordinary things that happen in football. And I would rather shift the balance back. And also, Matthew, you talked about, it's part of the job of people like me to shine a spotlight on it and say, all right, like, we might be pissing in the wind, but if we all shut up, it'll happen more often.
McClare's mailbag. McClare's mailbag. McClare's mailbag.
You've been in touch again with your questions for Chockey. So, Matthew, what have we got in the mailbag?
Okay, it's a pretty full mailbag because we have one for a while.
That's not what you say, though, is it?
What do you normally say? Something about me emptying my sack?
Is that sack, what? Yeah.
Come on, let's grow up. It's about time we grew up on this show,
okay,
isn't it?
Graham's not heard it before, so it's...
What I'll say is it's been a while, so my sack's pretty full. And the first one out of the sack is from A Standard Socialist, and they ask, what's your favourite Micro Disney album?
I've got a Micro Disney album. I can't tell you what it is.
All right. I don't even know. You're just going to leave it at that, are you?
Are they Belfast boys, Chuck? I think they're Belfast boys, aren't they? Have I made that up?
No, you could. Well, you've got more knowledge than I have, yeah. So I've got a Michael Disney album, yeah, but I can't tell you what it is.
Because you don't know, or because you don't want people to know?
What?
Because you don't know.
I'll tell you what. I bought Michael Disney album going back 35 years ago on vinyl.
Does this not come back to those old shoot interviews where you've referenced Micro Disney and then you've dropped yourself in it for future generations?
Potentially.
I think Graham knows what it is.
No, please, teacher. One, I said Belfast and it's Cork, so I'm in big trouble if I don't correct that. And two, I'm pretty sure, lads, Chucky Bot, we hate you South African bastards.
Ever there was an album that Chucky Bot, that sounds like...
Their debut 1984 album.
You going to confirm or deny, Brian?
That I've got a Micro Disney album. Or I did have. I definitely have a Micro Disney album.
Well, seeing as you're going to be in Cork, hold on. Seeing as you're going to be in Cork in a few weeks, I think you need to clarify this.
What? What are you going to be playing?
Well, no, you might get lynched. You don't know your local knowledge.
What? My local knowledge?
Well, the local band knowledge, I mean. I mean, do you want to confirm or do you want to move on to the next question?
No, I'm going to confirm that.
I would say you're frantically rooting through your LP collection there, but I assume you're not.
The clock comes down this... No, Crooked Mile.
Here we go. We got there
eventually. And
1987.
The Catalonian dude got the first one.
Well, he's also
got a big fan of South Africa.
We got there eventually. Right, okay. The next one comes from JBoy69, and they say, where did your old Celtic teammate Paul McStay rank amongst your greatest players you play with? And I know Mark would like to throw Danny McGrain into the question too, because they're still both so lauded in Scotland as greats of their time, but of course they don't get the same recognition down south because we rarely got to see them play either on TV or anywhere really in those days, like the greats of Dalglish, Hansen, and
there's two for me, from Celtic United, the Norman Whiteside United, and Paul McStay at Celtic. And Paul McStay was a wonderful football player and a cracking dude as well, and one of the best nicknames that I mentioned before in football.
Have you mentioned that before?
Well, maybe not, but his nickname was the Hat or Le Chapeau.
Why?
Because I think his hair was... I didn't give him the nickname. Maybe it was Tommy Burns again.
Tommy Burns.
Maybe Tommy Burns was that his hair was like a hat. So it didn't never moved. It was just there, kind of on his head, as like maybe the Tam O'Shanter that Mr. Hunt was talking about, without a bobble on the top. And his hair just didn't seem to move. So his nickname was the Hat or Le Chapeau. I just thought it was wonderful, you know. I'm not sure that Paul knew what Le Chapeau meant, but most people didn't know that. That was probably Tommy Burns. The Le Chapeau part of it was probably Tommy Burns.
We'll have to try and get him on the show sometime, because it'd be good to have like a wham reunion with you and him.
Yeah, he's in Australia, though, isn't he? So we have to
that doesn't stop us.
Let's have a look at that, yeah.
We're on Zoom these days. There's no such thing as time difference.
Any thoughts on Mr. McStay, Graham?
When I was living in Aberdeen and following the Dandies all over, it was Brian will confirm that it was a time when Rangers, the stadium renewal had sunk them a little bit. They were in a bit of a mess, and it's a happenstance that in the season that we won the Scottish Cup in 1982, which led to our domination of Europe and beating Real Madrid, we beat Rangers 4-1 at Hamden, and we'd beaten them at Pittodrie 3-0 the week before, so 7-1 over two weekends. Which leads me to say that it was Celtic that was the more thorny rival when we were really, really good domestically. And they were. And they had a good team. They hated playing against us. There was pitch invasions, chasing Lee Gordon all over the place. And the one guy who, Tommy always, his class was unquestionable. But he always hated losing. He worked really hard. The guy who strolled through every game against us, win, lose or draw, with a composure and a vision and a passing and a striking of the ball from distance. He wasn't appreciated in the Scottish amongst the Scottish fans and the Scottish media as much as he was at Parkhead, because he doesn't really resemble Ray Wilkins that much, but because people in general weren't as educated, there wasn't as much discussion about what was quality football, and you had your instincts, or maybe you played and you knew. But if you didn't have your instincts, and you didn't play, the discussion about what made a good football was much tighter, much narrower then. It was win-lose, and football was reported as nothing more than theatre in Scotland in the papers. There wasn't any analysis. And Paul played a game that was, ahead of his time would be a stupid thing to say, but he stood out in Scotland for having an ability to know where to be, a calmness, his touch was good. He would always, his passing range was unequalled in Scotland at the time. I think unequalled from midfield at the time. And against Paul, although he wasn't one of the ones like maybe Roy Aitken or Tommy Burns who'd be like, we're going to grill, we're going to holly Peter Grant, Paul just, it didn't matter if our team played brilliantly and winning or not, or whatever. He played football the same way, and you always knew there was threat. He carried threat. I don't think you find an Aberdeen fan that disliked him, even though he was a threat and played in the hoops. He was just a different quality football than I think existed in Scottish domestic football at the time.
Graham, that Aberdeen team you're talking about, I was just a little kid when they were sort of on top of the game in Scotland. And you look back at the names, and it was a great team. It didn't seem that there was one standout player. That maybe Celtic had in McStay and McClare, obviously. But if you take one person out of that Aberdeen team that were so good, that would have really diminished them and perhaps, would have meant Celtic being on top or Dundee United being on top, and you take one person out, who would that be? It would be the one that made them really tick.
I think there's an obvious answer, and Chalky could supply it, Mark. Fergie had a slightly different view. And maybe he was talking mostly about European football, because Alec always said that above and beyond the unit, Peter Weir elevated us. Peter Weir did things that people couldn't cope with and glided past footballers and was beautiful. I mean, it was just beautiful to watch him play. It was gorgeous. But it's obviously by a distance, as brilliant as Gordon Strachan was, as much as I love Tatty Cooper, as good a goalkeeper as Leighton was, as good a footballer as big Alec McLeish was, it's obviously by a fucking country mile, Willie Miller. Partly because of how good a footballer he was, what a good leader he was, what a phenomenal tackler he was. But just like, I remember Alex Ferguson when I was in London, Mark, did a piece with, flipping heck, Glenn Gibbons in The Scotsman. And it picked up and used all over England. And the question, because obviously he was talking to a better man than you are to me, was, Alex, which footballers didn't need you in their career? And I think he might have listed four. And of them, he'd listed, he took it back later, but he listed Cantona, Keane, one other, and Willie Miller. So if Fergie says that Willie Miller didn't need Alex Ferguson to get to, there's only one captain and Scottish captain who's ever lifted two European trophies, it's Willie Miller. He's a Glaswegian, not an Aberdonian. That mattered, just like Alex Glaswegianism mattered. But he was ferocious. is ferocious to this day. And that combination of attitude, aggression, will to win, captaincy, and being a very, very good footballer. All the years I spent in England, I tormented all the English journalists and fans. Bobby Moore Pish, the greatest central defender that ever came out of Britwood. I said it for a reason, Mark, and that's the answer to your question. If Willie Moore hadn't existed or you took him out of the team forever, then to say we wouldn't have achieved the things might be too much, but I'm scared that it would mean that if you took him out, we wouldn't have achieved those things.
Mm. He was also very good at managing referees.
This is one of those Donald Trump lads. I don't know how much you let Chucky get away with week in, week out, but this is something that nobody ever commented on in the 80s, and Trump's been putting this fucking shit out about Willie Miller and referees, and it's like a sort of, you know, George Bush knew about, you know, 9/11 and all that and stuff. It didn't start until about 2017, this stuff about Willie Miller and referees. Who is the referee? Was it McCluskey, Brian? Was it McCluskey one of the referees in your just Jim McCluskey, is that right? I went to Willie's farewell dinner down in some mad dinner down in Ayrshire, and they put McCluskey at our table, and I felt he kind of went for your team a lot when we saw McCluskey sitting there at the table, and it's black tie and all that, and there's been a lot of chat. He's not next to me, but he's three away. As the cigars come out, people move away, and I turn to Jim McCluskey and so what is it you do? I'm a referee. Oh, really? Amateur? Oh,
Fuds.
Satisfaction.
So guaranteed.
Why do you bring that up? Do you think that was a Fergie trait, Brian, or is it just...
I played for Motherwell and I played for Celtic against Aberdeen, and Willie Miller is very good at managing referees, and I'm not saying that they were biased, but he was good at it. Doing the wrong good, I mean, same kind of thing that happened. The chipping, everybody chipping away, all sorts of things, and particularly at home. Yeah, Willie was brilliant. But yeah, I would agree that if you take Willie Miller out of that team, they wouldn't have achieved what they did achieve. And he's a cracking lad as well. You know, that's not.
I don't know if you're a fan of dry humour at all, Chucky, but you and Willie would be up there on the podium, I think.
Do you remember, was it the Fast Show or something? You used to have all these mad staring competitions, you know, and it would be your man, the football commentator, going, I'm here in Azerbaijan, and he's staring. The idea about you and Willie on a 12-hour marathon, I'm not fucking laughing at him. And standing there cracking dry, funny
genie. No, nothing. That would be an Olympic fucking sport.
Just before we go, it's not a mailbag question, but it's something that's been noted in the last couple of days. There's a significant anniversary that I think you were going to ask Brian about, Mark, that was mentioned on Twitter this week.
It was, yeah. It's about... What was quoted on Twitter as being one of the greatest assists of all time. It looked more like a 5-yard toe poke into space to me, but yeah, it was for a certain David Beckham goal from inside his own half against Wimbledon. Don't suppose anybody remembers who did make that little toe poke to nobody?
Well, I think you're exaggerating it big time, because 5 yards is 15 feet. I would say it was less than... The most would be 3 feet. But when I came on as sub in that game, and that was my first touch of the ball, and when I came on sub, the manager's instructions were, Alex Ferguson, is we've won the game, get on there and make sure we keep it tight and fucking close down the game. So I go on with this idea in my head, right, okay, Selhurst Park against Wimbledon, right, keep it close out. I get the ball comes to me, and I pass it to David, thinking, right, he's just inside his own half. And I can see him shaping up, because I knew I'd played with David several times even before he got into the first team. And I knew what his idea of doing some things where he always wanted to hit the ball as far as he possibly could. And I can see him shaping up, and I'm going, "What the fuck are you doing?" And it's like the manager's told me to, you know, just keep the ball and you just give it back to me or give it to whoever, and we'll keep the ball for the next period of time, and we'll kill the game. But no. He's shaping up, and I'm going, the fuck, you're going to get a bollocking for this, a hairdryer, and I watch the ball, and you can't really see because it's so far away, but you know it's going in because even at Selhurst, we always had Man United also the majority of the support, irrespective of playing Crystal Palace or Wimbledon at the time. And the ball sails out over and erupts behind the goals. And all I could think about was fucking Scottish goalkeeper. Because it was Sullivan that was in goals. And I jumped on his back, and then that's one of the reasons why I'm in all the pictures around there. And I was on the pitch for seconds when that happened. So.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt, given you said you were going to finish. And maybe I get this wrong, and I completely arse myself. Was it not you that did all the work for Cantona's goal as well?
Yeah, I did that.
Just going to mention that.
Yeah.
And he also got in all the pictures for that one as well.
Yeah. Well, you learn early on, you know, if you're going to be if you're going to have some longevity in your whole life, getting next to the goal scorer.
Yeah, I mean, for everything you did for United, you know, scoring 31 goals in your first season, breaking
none of that,
the two goals you're most remembered for are the 2 5-yard assists of Cantona and Beckham.
I have to ask this. Maybe you want me to clear off until you finish the mailbag of the last questions.
No, I
have to say, it's two things. One, when I was at Glasgow Uni, I lived in Queen Margaret Halls of Residence, and there was a colleges league of a Saturday morning. And one of the earliest versions of an urban myth I ever encountered was at some stage, either during Motherwell or pre-Motherwell days, you'd been a student of, I don't know, accountancy or sciences.
Maths, physics, chemistry.
And the word was that you'd played in the colleges league.
I played.
In the Saturday morning colleges league.
No, I played a five-a-side game.
Okay.
I played a five-a-side game against Strathclyde Uni.
See, this went everywhere. Everybody, Brian McClure played in this league, you know.
Yeah, but
is that because you weren't allowed, Brian, isn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't allowed. But the weird thing about it is that the guy who was taking the team, or the five-a-side team, or whatever team was at Glasgow Uni where I was, his dad was assistant manager at Motherwell. So he was encouraging me and his dad's. Frank Connor was a very fierce man, you know. So he get badgering me. I won't tell my dad. So I played this, you know what it's like, you know, with university. It's like university challenge. It was this a five-a-side game. And I think I played a five-a-side game for Glasgow University, Strathclyde Uni.
Yeah, well, at least it's half two. Another thing I want to, before I get kicked off this, if people haven't read Pat Nevin's book, which is a fantastic book, please go out and read it. But also, it's a brilliant chapter about you and Pat at the table, arguing the toss with fucking Hansen.
Is it in the book? I've not seen his book.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Mr. Hansen and Mr. Dalgleish, I believe it was.
That's correct. That's
yeah.
And yeah. You two come out. I mean, Pat's the teller, so you two should come out of it well. But I think anybody who's got any brains between their ears will recognise who the cool characters and anecdotes.
So what did Pat say? What did he say?
You can read it for yourself and take it up with him. But there's a point at which you are both relatively new. Pat certainly feels quite new.
Both of us put you together.
Dalgleish and Hansen at the table. And as some Hansen proclaims that X is Y, and that's working it. And one of you, probably Pat, and Hansen's fucking two-footed in a better, more two-footed tackle ever made for Scotland against USSR and Malaga, the lazy bastard bumping into one another. Yeah, forgiveness is a lovely concept. And Pat tells it that there was a little bit between the two. Now we're going to stand a corner here. And it got sufficiently intense that the manager came and plucked the two of you away from the table to take you away from the two established stars because things were getting a tiny bit bumpy at the time.
No, they left the table. That's what happened. They, both of them, got up and left the table. So it goes back to the same sort of thing that what you were talking about with Cathy Ferguson. listened to it to a long time ago was that they were trying to intimidate Pat because Pat wanted to be different, like you just said, about being different and all that kind of thing. And he's your mate, and I wasn't having it. I know, and I accept that these are two wonderful football players and two whatever they are, but that you've got to stick up for your mate. And I stuck up for my mate, and they left.
He did say, in fairness, he did say you went back to your room afterwards and absolutely pissed yourself laughing about it for about half an hour. So, which
I but that was part of the thing, because it was like, we were like young people. We were like, well, what's it going to be? We didn't have any kind of version of this could be the end of our international career or anything like that. We were just saying, we were just treating it as any other discussion with people who we thought were out of order. And if you're going to give out banter, it's a lesson to get. If you're going to give out banter, then you've got to accept you're going to get it back from whoever. And we thought, well, we'll give you a bit back. And they didn't like it, and they left. So when we were like, there was a bit of thing where they just got abruptly left and all that kind of thing. We finished the dinner and went back to them. And we were like laughing and joking about it. And there was no mention of that. There was no mention about it after that. Both Kenny and Jockey's careers and his international players finished after that. And we were involved in a few squads after that, but it's just a simple thing about is it right, is it wrong? Clearly for me it was wrong, and I think we were proven to be correct about that.
And you're grand.
Okay, that's us done then, and I think we've successfully managed to blow the pre-season cobwebs away. Graham, thanks so much for being on the podcast. It's been a pleasure having you on.
I can't believe you had me on. It still seems like a dream. It's been very funny. So much of my life that I've got a cramp. I've got a muscle between my ribs, which is in spasms because I've laughed too much.
Not what a joy. On the toilet for the last hour and a half.
Matthew,
the best place. The best place, and he admitted it. It's wonderful. To turn around, you've admitted it. You're sitting on the lavvy. Having the...
If it wasn't for your lavvy, where would you be? You'd be in the living room or on the balcony. Lads, I can't believe you asked me on, but you made me laugh. So
cheers,
much.
Man.
Thank you, sir.
Chucky, Matthew, cheers, boys.
Thank you, sir.
Good to be back.
Okay. Well, you can join us next time. You know where to find us by now on all the usual podcast providers. And we're on Twitter at Brian McClare Pod 2 for mailbag entries and anything else, really. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you soon.
Life with Brian. Life with Brian. Talking films or music. Life with Brian. Talking TV and food. Life with Brian. Talking trivia and exercise. Life with different every episode. Life with Brian, talking politics and football. Life with Brian, it's different every episode. Life with Brian, life with Brian.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.